Sergio Escamilla is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison officials are preparing to execute Escamilla by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, Chief Legal Analyst Jim Skelton, with Legal Analysts Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Pat Hartwell. Houston Vigil reporter Dave Edwards. The execution watch for Licho Escamilla begins. Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?
My name is Ray Hill, and this is Execution Watch on radio station KPFT FM Houston. We're on HD1 channel and broadcast channel tonight because fundraising is apparently closed, and so we get back into the big office. If you tune in to listen to Susan and her fine selections on Border Radio, you can still do that. You can go to the HD2 channel if you have that kind of equipment, or you can just go to www.kpft.org, check out the HD2 sound, and that's Susan at Border Radio. Bless her, she worked so hard during fundraising. Well, let's begin with Pat. Pat is called in. Pat, this is Ray. Pat?
I'm sorry, the motorcycles were going by.
Vroom, vroom. This is one of those things, right?
Yes, it is one of those things. And we have a group out here. The witnesses, the media has already passed. Here comes his three sisters right now, and his wife is crossing over now.
You know Licho.
Well, I didn't know him well, but yes, I knew him. We also have, I have to say, we have a good crowd. We have the Journey of Hope here.
Oh, that's right. They're passing through Texas right now.
Yes, one of the founders of the Journey of Hope is here. If you'd like,
Why don't you put him or her on so that I can talk about schedule?
It's Bill Peltnik.
Okay. Hey, Bill.
Hello,
Bill. This is Ray Hill. You remember me?
Hi, Ray. How you doing?
Well, I'm not happy whenever I have to do one of these shows.
I understand that. But I'm not happy to be here at, when they're committing state-sanctioned murder.
The Journey of Hope is passing through Texas. Do you have in the back of your mind a schedule of stops along the trail?
Well, we're going to be in Houston till Friday.
Okay.
There's actually a clergy luncheon at the Dominican Sisters in Houston tomorrow at 11 o'clock, and then we leave Saturday and go to San Antonio for 6 days, and then we'll be in Austin for the last couple of days where it'll be the March, 16th annual march to abolish the death penalty.
How long have you been with the Journey?
I've been with the Journey since 1993.
And you've been literally all over the world?
All over the world, yes.
And
been about 40 states and 16 different countries.
And everywhere you go except right here, you get warm reception.
Well, it's not always a warm reception, but Texas is definitely different than all the other states in the union.
Well, I want you to give our regards. I was planning on attending the luncheon tomorrow, but I have some personal health issues that prevent me from doing that. But give my love to the troop.
Well, I sure will.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, Ray. You want Pat back?
No, she's giving me the information we need. She'll get back when she's got more information.
Okay, thanks, Ray. God bless everyone.
Thank you, sir. And that's the Journey of Hope, which travels around the country. Have we got somebody else on hold? I think she's not quite there yet. Okay. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, it's pretty simple and clear.
Wait a minute. He needs a microphone. Oh, you're ready for this? Let's take this. Is it Dave? Dave, are you there? Dave.
Oh, 18-wheeler going by me right now.
Well, they had motorcycles in Huntsville, and you got 18-wheelers here.
Right. Yeah, we're here. Corner, are we on?
You're on right now.
Okay, it's corner of Almeda and Holcomb over by the Dominican Sisters is where we're located today. And it's a little bit of a challenge because they're doing construction over here, but we've got, seven people right now.
Oh.
And, Ron Carlson's with us. Ron hasn't been out for a long time. He's here. George White, with Journey of Hope. Marietta Yeager Lane with the Journey of Hope. And we've got, Ron's wife and, my wife.
Well, Journey of Hope.
And, Jennifer Simmons is here, so Journey, we've got a good group.
Journey of Hope is having a luncheon right near where you are tomorrow.
Tomorrow at 11 o'clock, it's going to be like a brunch, and people are welcome to come to it. It's open to the public. We'd like people to RSVP, but you know, I don't know how, if anybody wants to come tomorrow, I'd say just come on over. 11 o'clock at the Dominican Sisters. 6501 Almeda Road.
And that's Almeda at OST. No, Almeda at Hopa.
And wife are witnessing.
We've got feedback. I've got two phones on the line at the same time.
Sue just talking to.
Yeah, I'm getting a little interference here, but it's all right.
Drop Pat.
Okay. Anyway, yes, so people are welcome to come to that. I think Archbishop Fiorenza is going to be there, and it's going to be a very nice event. It's part of the Journey of Hope programs that we're having this week.
Well, what is the Journey of Hope?
The Journey of Hope is basically a speaking tour made up of people who have, it's a combination of people who have lost a loved one to murder and still opposed the death penalty. It's exonerated death row prisoners. And it's people who have either a family member on death row or they've had a family member executed. And so I think the journey this time has got about, I think, 15 people all together. We have three people from Italy. We have one person from Germany. And they go out and they talk in schools, in churches. We had Sister Helen Prejean was here for a couple of days as part of it.
And so if folks,
it's an educational program.
If folks want to get networked into folks who have those thoughts and ideas, they could go to the Dominican Sisters convent tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Well, they're going to have difficulty finding where the meeting is?
No, it's going to be in the big meeting room. When you first come in the gate, there's a parking lot to the left. Just park there, come around the corner, and it'll be pretty obvious where we are.
Well, the witnesses have crossed the road, so we know what that means.
Yeah. I want to mention, too, I don't know if you've talked with Pat yet, but there are, we've got some of the Journey of Hope folks here.
Yeah.
At this, and there's some up in Huntsville.
I talked to one of the founders.
Good. Great.
Okay.
And so thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. Bye-bye.
All righty. Yep. Bye-bye.
Now, Jim. What about this case?
Well, it's not terribly complicated. This young man, Nietzsche Escamillo, had gone to a club one night in Dallas, and he had murdered somebody about two or three weeks earlier in West Dallas. There was a warrant for his arrest for murder. It had already been filed, but he hadn't been arrested yet. And while he's at the club, he gets into a fracas and argues with some people, and they take it outside, as they often do in these clubs. There's a big fight going on out near the valet parking lot. And there were five different Dallas police officers working off duty. And it was interesting because apparently, according to the records, this club had a reputation for being pretty bad. They had five off-duty officers just keeping looking, trying to keep people behaving themselves. Well, Escamillo was getting the worst end of the fight. So two officers, one of which was a man by the name of Christopher James, 34 years old. Licho at this time was a 19-year-old kid. They go over to break up the fight and try to pull him away. And in the midst of pulling him away and getting the fight, he pulls a gun, begins to shoot at this officer as well as another officer. shoots one officer in the wrist, shoots this officer in the shoulder, hits him twice, knocks him to the ground. Then he steps over the officer he had shot in the arm, and the other officer, Officer James, is laying on the ground, and he steps over and puts three bullets in the back of his head. And then at that point, he attempts to flee. Well, he does flee. And, of course, other officers are chasing him, and they're shooting at each other back and forth. And he tries to hijack a car about a block away, and people tackle him and stop him. So he's caught at the scene, and there's no question about guilt. He's caught, you know, at the murder weapon there. He ended up shooting a total of 12 shots because his gun was completely empty when they caught him. And he was shot, wasn't shot seriously. He was glazed with a bullet, and they took him to the hospital, arrested him. And as soon as they got him, as soon as they treated him for the bullet wounds, they took him to jail and charged him with capital murder.
There's no co-defendants or
anything? None whatsoever. He's all by himself. And it also, there was some evidence he's a member of a gang, which you would probably expect in someone like this young in that area of Dallas. But it was a, like I say, this was the second person he killed within less than a month.
Now, did the cops know that he had a warrant for the murder?
Well, they were completely unaware of it. All they saw was a fight in the parking lot.
But he knew what had happened.
Oh, absolutely, because he had killed somebody and a warrant had been issued for his arrest. Just hadn't been executed yet, so I'm sure he knew there was an outstanding warrant. Police officers who went up to pull him out of the fight had no earthly idea who he was. In fact, they went to rescue him out of the fight, and that's when he shot both of them.
Well, what kind of previous record did he have?
Had a kind of a long juvenile record. I think we're going to cover that when we talk about the writ part, because he had, and you know, you, as so often you see in these cases, the kids been in reform school and they've had juvenile records, and this is one of those, I hate to say typical cases, but it's one of those typical cases we often see where someone gets in trouble as a youth and kind of graduates up to adult crimes.
And so this young man is 19 years old.
19 at the time.
And this is 20 years, or 10 years ago.
Right.
And
he's 30-something now.
Yeah,
so.
He got out and he went to a party or went to a club, and a fight broke out. He was drunk, stupid. And
right.
All this come down and... What, 45 seconds, 60 seconds?
All came down to a matter of probably how long does it take to shoot two people, the ones on the ground, shoot them three times in the head. And really what, it was unnecessary because both officers were on the ground at that time. There's no reason to shoot them. And he could have run off then, but he, I don't know why he chose to step over one, shoot one in the head three times.
I know from some people on death row that Lee chose a youngster. He's one of the kids they raise, they call him, and that he's pretty popular on the row.
That I wouldn't know. I'm sure that's probably true.
All right. Where do we go from here?
I think we're going to talk about some of the stuff he did afterwards, and I've asked Michael to do that, some of the because I think what really not only was the murder.
By the way, the speaker is Jim Skelton.
Right. And not only was the murder kind of a senseless thing, that really the thing that really hurt him was his conduct after the murder, and I think Michael's going to cover that.
Okay, we got Mike Gillespie. Hey, Mike.
Hello, Ray. One of the issues that he wanted...
Mike, we'll get your microphone.
One of the issues that he brought up on appeal was that in order to be accused of capital murder of a police officer, they have to prove that you knew he was a police officer. Well, he tried to claim that he didn't know he was a police officer. Unfortunately, you've got a litany of people who he mouthed off to between the time he was arrested and the time he went to jail. It seemed like in the hospital he bragged to everybody there about, I just shot a cop. He admitted he shot a cop. He admitted he knew he was a cop. He admitted he shot him. Nobody questioned him. Nobody asked him any interrogatory questions. They just, on his own, he started yelling, everybody, I just shot a cop. That hurt his argument that he did not know it was a cop because of that.
Well, did they raise that at the trial?
It was raised at the trial that he did not know he was a police officer.
Because what they're trying to do is get it reduced from capital murder to straight murder.
Straight murder, yeah. Mm-hmm. And at that time, if you got a straight murder, you were eligible for parole in 25 or 30 years.
So he was trying to undo his own statements because his own statements, he admitted he knew he was a police officer and he shot him. Plus, he showed no respect for the dead cop the way he described the dead cop, and that did not help him either in this case. The more interesting aspect to it has got to do with whether or not after he was admitted to the to jail, after being at the hospital, after all these statements came out, he was interviewed by a TV crew in the jail. And during the interview on the jail, he said the same thing. He admitted that he shot a cop. He tried to get that interview suppressed based upon the fact that the police officer was an undercover agent for the authorities.
The interviewer.
Interviewer was an undercover agent for the authorities. The courts held there's a test of that, and this is not meet the test. He was in the interviewer was not an employee of the police, was not being directed by the police. He was just doing an interview, and the man just blurted out again that he just shot a cop. The question as far as the...
So in order for the state to build its case...
Michael, it's interesting, though, what the police officer said to him. That's an interesting point. Remember when the TV reporter got permission to interview him, they just worried about the police blocking. Remember what the policeman told him?
The policeman made a remark that could be interpreted to say, get us an interview.
Right.
But that wasn't how it was interpreted. He was trying to say, we're tired of trying to get an interview from this
guy. A confession, not an interview.
A confession. We're tired of trying to get a confession. The other thing which is interesting is that the courts held that the outbreaks that he came out with in the waiting room of the hospital was not considered to be where he was interrogated by the police officers because he wasn't being asked any questions. Your protection is from police officers asking you questions to self-incriminate yourself. There's no law in the book that prevents people from saying stupid things on their own.
A news crew go waltzing into the jail.
Well, we're talking about two different things. At the hospital, the doctor, first thing when it came up, a doctor to see if he was lucid, so you know why you're here.
Yeah.
And that was a doctor question. There were policemen present. He said, yes, I shot a faggot cop.
Okay.
And so that came in response to the doctor's question to see if he was lucid.
Oh, okay.
And then when the newspaper reporter goes, what I thought was interesting about that, he said, you're going to try to block me, asked the sergeant in charge of the investigation, you're going to try to block me from talking to this kid. And the cop laughs and says, no, we want you to. We can't get him to confess. Maybe you can. And that's what they hung their hat on, is that comment. We can't get him to confess, but maybe you can. That's what they hung their hat on and trying to claim that.
But that didn't
when
work.
The reporter went in to talk to the defendant, Lucio, that he was in fact an agent for the police department. It should have been given a Miranda warning as opposed to just a mere TV man talking. That's where they hung their hat on.
Actually, whether it's a hospital or a jail, you got a client in there.
Right.
They're very vulnerable to anybody who walks in there and ask them any question at all. Your client may be too stupid to keep his mouth shut. As apparently that happens.
I think Mike said it well.
From time to time. Okay, so the deal is that as a lawyer, how do you protect your client from that?
Michael, how do you do that?
You try to teach your client not to talk.
At all?
At all. I have clients take the Fifth Amendment when pretrial bond tries to get him information to bond him out of jail. And they say, I don't got to talk to you. My lawyer says not to talk to anybody.
All right. You're raising them right over there.
But that's not the right way to do it.
Well, Larry's got an expression on his face. Larry, you want to weigh in on this?
Well, I mean, the only thing to do is just tell your client not to talk. The problem with that is if you're saying a client who's too stupid not to talk, even after you tell them not to, occasionally they still want to talk anyway. Now, I'm not even sure whether Escamilla had a lawyer at the time. I assume he did. But this is, a few days. He's in jail.
It's right after the incident.
So it's right after the incident.
You know, he's in the hospital.
About a couple of days later.
A couple of days later, okay. But he's already said so many things. I mean, even at the scene, he asked the police officers, why didn't you guys kill me? That's what I wanted you to do. Okay. And then I shot a faggot cop, and he's going on and on about what he's doing, not just to the police on the scene, in the presence of the police at the hospital when the doctor's just trying to treat him, and to a news, outfit. So he's talking over and over again. It's almost as though he's seeking attention.
Well, I get arrested on a regular basis for little chicken stuff cases.
Chicken what?
stuff.
Okay, I'm
chicken
sorry.
Stuff cases.
Okay.
And I'll talk to them, but only with my lawyer sitting in my lap.
See, I always think the best way to handle that is tell your client, say, I'd be more than happy to talk to you, but I'd like to have my lawyer here when I do it. And that way, that kind of lessens thing. Rather than say, just shut up. You say, I'd love to talk
maybe
to you.
Maybe I should leave the lap part out.
And I would love to talk to you. I'd be happy to do so, but please let me have my lawyer be present when I talk to you. I think that's probably the better advice to give.
And in my experience on those kinds of cases, Jim, I do that a lot myself, mm-hmm. is that just ends the conversation. They really don't try to talk to them. You never hear them say, okay, get your lawyer down.
Larry, I've been there.
Okay.
They'll send a committee. Now, Raymond, we just want you to tell us what happened. And I said, you're crazy. And I got to tell you what happened.
And I do tell my clients, you know, give them my name. Here's my phone number. This is my cell phone. You can get me down here anytime. But I've never had them take me up on it.
Okay. Mike, is there anything else about this case that's a different twist?
Well, the interesting twist on this one was whether or not this man was a police officer in the line of duty. This is a varied opinion about this. The law says that all policemen are on duty 24 hours a day.
Yeah, well, that the certified police officer 24/7 job. How practicable is that?
Well, that's the problem, because a police officer on duty 24 hours a day is on duty when he's asleep in his house.
Or drunk.
He's on duty when he's drunk. He's on duty when he's fighting with his wife. He's on duty all the time.
Or visiting his girlfriend at a service station.
Or visiting his girlfriend at a service station. As we all know, we have a case in Houston that's going to be coming up that's got this very issue to it.
And that's shaping up as an issue in that case.
Absolutely.
Exactly right. Because at first the reports was the police officer was filling his tank with gasoline, and now it looks like that he was there to meet a girl he was dating. Now, whether or not he can be doing both at the same time, I don't know. But I would imagine that when they want to give the death penalty to somebody, they want to give the death penalty for somebody who is a police officer acting like a police officer, not a police officer acting like he's got nothing else to do.
Well, see, it's really more than that, because in order to have the death penalty, he's got to be in the performance of his lawful duty. If he's not in the performance of his lawful duty, the law will not permit a death penalty. It's more than that. It's very critical.
Is that in the statute?
Because in order to do a capital murder case on a police officer, he's got to be in the performance of his lawful duty. If he's not, it's not a capital murder. That's exactly the argument being made in the Houston case, is that the officer he stopped by to see his girlfriend was not in the performance of his lawful duty. Therefore, it's not a capital murder case.
Do you expect they're going to plumb that pretty thoroughly?
Absolutely. That's all they got.
Well, let's talk on this case. How does this work? There's no question that he was not on lawful duty. He was on a part-time job. He was not performing acts as a police officer, even though he was commissioned. Then he sees a fight break out. When he saw the fight break out, he did not know that one of the people in the fight was a known fugitive felon with a felony warrant on him. So if he would have known that, he would have been in the line of duty, but he didn't know that. Is just breaking up a fight considering the line of duty when you're an off-duty police officer working in private security?
I would think it would be, though. Because you talked about this earlier, that he wasn't in the line of duty till he saw the fight. And then when he tried to break it up, he was in the official line of duty. It's what we talked about earlier.
But even when he saw the fight, though, I mean, wouldn't he have to do that as a security guard, just like any other security guard? Because he's being paid to do that. I mean, I guess that's the argument.
Right.
I think the question is, were you in the line of duty trying to stop a fight or make an arrest? If you're a security guard and you see two people fighting, your job is to stop the fight, not necessarily arrest somebody, because then you're not going to be a security guard anymore. You're going to have to go put somebody in jail.
I suspect that his job was not to break up fights and things. I suspect his job was to provide some protection for the club.
You're probably right, Ray.
Which is what security guards do.
Yeah, I mean, you hire off-duty cops to scare away other cops because your business model is so on the line that you don't want your employees to get arrested and you have to hire them lawyers.
In fact, we have more people arrested in Houston, Harris County than any other place I'm aware of for assaulting police officers in bars. because in most jurisdictions, the policemen are not allowed to work extra duty jobs. They pay them enough money so a police officer, when he's not working, can be home with his family, getting rest for a very dangerous job the next day, not out working all night to make extra time money. The reason you have so many people arrested fighting with policemen in bars is that high-priced athletes are not used to being manhandled by security guards.
Michael. Police officers tell me that they can go over here on Washington Avenue and work off-duty jobs and get paid $1,200 a night.
And that makes them work in their full-time
placements. No, that's probably a four-hour job. Yeah.
Well, when Jack Lee just walked in, because I'd asked Jake, and what we're talking about, Jack, we're discussing the issue that you've been assigned to talk about.
Who's a cop? When they're a cop?
Off-duty policeman.
When can I kill them and when I can't?
Well, my advice is never to kill anyone.
Okay.
Unless he's Chinese.
If you're a communist, there tends to be a prerogative to cleanse large swaths of people. The basic question here is at what point is a cop doing his duty?
Yeah.
In the line of duty, and it becomes a capital crime when an officer is killed in the line of duty. In this case, yeah, it's kind of a gray line. If you ask police, well, they're always on duty, especially if you're in uniform. Police are told, look, if you don't want to be expected to be on duty, take your uniform off, and even when you have your uniform off, you're expected to intercede in major offenses, minor offenses, minor assaults, bar brawls and things like that. If you're not in uniform, you can be expected, you can walk away, but when something gets, much more heated, you're expected to do something about it.
Well, according to this story, the cops came to rescue the guy that shot him.
Yeah, and they were in and the police were in uniform.
All of them.
All of them were in uniform.
Okay.
And so, you now have a situation where, if you ask the police, yes, they were in the line of duty, even though this was a second job. In a lot of jurisdictions, they forbid you from taking on a second job.
While we're talking about this, the Licho Escamilla is being escorted into death chamber. He's probably wired up because the witness is across the road. We're waiting on words whether or not the process is over. You've been listening to Jack Lee, and before him, Mike Gillespie. And Larry Douglas is our practicing attorney, and our wizard, of course, is none other than Jim Skelton. These cases, this is not an academic discussion. They're killing somebody right now. And so whenever we're talking about who's a cop and when they're a cop and what saith the statute, because I suppose these things are supposed to follow the law.
Exactly. And in fact, the indictment will read, when they read the indictment, that he's informers of his lawful duty, did knowingly shoot an officer and kill an officer when he was in line of his official duty. They talk, that's
and,
an element
and,
of the
and,
case.
And the state had to prove all those
Absolutely.
Elements. Prove all those elements. And we're talking about a guy that was 19 years old, probably drunk and stoned at the time. He had been active in some other criminal activities. But he didn't stand a chance.
No.
There was not a chance that this was going to turn out any other way.
He didn't help it any by killing another officer.
But that's that lip stuff. Yeah, you can talk yourself into getting executed in Texas real easily, and a lot of people do that.
One thing we failed to mention, we just didn't have time to do it, not only did he did all the running in his mouth during the trial, he apparently got mad at the jury and threw a pitcher of water over toward the jury. That certainly didn't help any.
I wouldn't.
It didn't
think
hit anybody,
help.
But that's.
If you were sitting on that junior, that would have been.
Yeah, I think that would. If I were the defense attorney, I would think that.
Well, Licho's in his early 30s. He is come to be well-known and popular on death row. I remember some earlier stage in his development, somebody on death row referring to him as one of their kids. They get a lot of kids on death row, especially in, before the 18-year-old line was drawn for execution. Get a lot of kids on death row, and the other inmates on death row feel like they've got to raise them as parents. So they refer to them as their kids. And that's Alicho. Larry, is there anything else about this case?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Alicho Escamilla had been found guilty of capital murder. So the trial moved into the punishment phase. And the punishment phase for capital murder, the two competing issues are future dangerousness and mitigation. The problem with mitigation is there anything in his background that would suggest to the jury that he should not be put to death? And the lawyer has to determine what to present. First, you got to find out what it is and then decide whether to present it or not. The writ lawyers claimed ineffective assistance of counsel primarily on the issue of mitigation. For the ineffective assistance of counsel, to show that, you've got to show that the attorney was, the attorney's performance was
subpar. You're supposed to be looking for it and find something and present
well,
it.
Well, you've got to find that the attorney's performance was subpar. That is, not a reasonable level of performance. And that subpar performance resulted in the result, that is the death penalty, say, but for the subpar performance, then the result would have been different, that he would not have gotten the death penalty. So, and then that's the whole reason for doing the mitigation, presenting the mitigation evidence.
Well, is this the kind of evidence that we get the appellate court saying, well, that's true, but it wouldn't have made any difference?
If you're looking solely at the at the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, what the court is trying to determine is, was the counsel's performance ineffective or not? That is, was it subpar and would it have made a difference anyway? And that's the issue that's being raised. Now, at the trial court level, you've got all this, you know, everything that's at guilt innocence goes into punishment. So we've got all the thing that we talked about him doing before. That is, he's already got a murder. He's already been charged with murder. He kills a police officer, shoots him twice in the head, runs away, says that I shot a fat cop, tells everybody that. Is anybody, and they also tell it to the news media. And as Jim mentioned, even at trial, he throws a pitcher of water toward the jury in their direction. And these are the people who are going to decide whether we're going to kill you or not. He does this. Now, and at trial, the counsel introduced evidence showing that Alicho had a pretty normal life up until about the age of 11 years old.
Okay.
That he had two supportive parents, that he was a fairly well-adjusted child. But then at the age of 11, you know, one of his brothers was arrested trying to protect him. And this set him on a downward spiral, and then his mother died, and he started using drugs and started getting involved in gangs. And so at that young age, he was so impressionable that he went off on the wrong path. And but for that, he would have been okay. So you need to spare his life. Apparently, that didn't work.
Do we have reason to believe that was presented?
That is what was presented, generally what was presented at the trial court level. The writ lawyers then looked back and they hired a mitigation investigator. But they presented evidence of mitigation at the writ level to suggest that he really didn't have the greatest childhood. That actually his father abused his mother. He was impressed by his older brothers who were gang members. He looked up to them. He started using drugs a whole lot earlier. So it was actually conflicting with the mitigation evidence submitted at trial and may or may not even have been mitigating at all. But that was what they had. So they're saying the trial counsel was ineffective because he failed to submit this other supposedly mitigating evidence. The court did not accept that argument, though, because it's even presenting that conflicting evidence from the trial court on mitigation. If he'd done that, if the trial counsel had submitted, it's a strange argument, but if he had submitted conflicting evidence on mitigation, would that act have been substantially subpar performance, and would that subpar performance have resulted in a different outcome? And a different outcome in a capital murder case would be just get one juror to say,
yeah, you
not
only
the death
you
penalty.
Only got to convince one,
just one, and it's not death, it's life.
Okay, I think we have a report from Huntsville. What's okay? It's Pat. Put Pat on. Pat.
To be on the air to tell you that when the witnesses walked out, the cops saw to it that they started cheering. The cops cheered when the witnesses walked out because we know that the execution is over. So this is what we have in Huntsville, Texas night when someone has been executed. The cops have cheered.
Well, Pat, you know that there are no more bloodthirsty people on this planet than the advocates for execution.
Exactly, and I'm the one that's having to hold up the friends and the family out here while they cheer.
But we appreciate your doing that work, or trying to do that work. It may or may not be effective, but it is important work to do, whether you win or lose, sister.
I understand.
Okay, well,
I want to tell the death row guys, keep your heads up. We love you.
Okay, thank you, Pat. And for, thank you for your stalwart nature.
See you later, Ray.
Okay. Licho, bye-bye. Licho Escamilla, if I can get attention in here. Licho Escamilla is now dead. State of Texas killed him a few minutes ago. The witnesses have come out, and we know that is in the cops, who always show up when it's a cop killing. Well, they ride the motorcycles up there, and you hear the rattle of Harleys out in the sidewalk, and they're cheering.
Ray, one thing I was going to ask you. You said they're the most bloodthirsty group. Obviously, you've never been married, have you?
No.
Okay, I thought so. Go ahead.
Let the record show.
I think that.
Let the record show. I've had some interesting companions, but I've never been married.
Okay.
In terms of mitigation evidence, Ray, the kind of mitigation that was introduced in this case is actually a two-edged sword. And so even the mitigation evidence that was produced at trial, the prosecutor used some of that evidence against Escamilla. Because when you're trying to decide whether you're going to put a person to death or not, when you look at his entire background, well, if he's been a wrongdoer for that long, does that mitigate?
Sure. You leave the jury, as Jim once put it, in a quandary. We won't let this guy live because he ain't going to change.
So you didn't have a whole lot of evidence saying he was a member of the Boy Scouts. He went to church every Sunday.
In fact, he's in reform school during part of that, wasn't he?
He was.
Yeah.
We don't know whether that reform school had a scout troop in it or not.
They did a scout troop, not like you would think of one.
He attacked a principal.
Okay.
Okay. So when you look through his entire background, you don't have the traditional mitigation. So for whatever reason, the lawyers feel like I've got to put something on for mitigation to suggest to the jury, and it's the lawyer's call to suggest to the jury that he's worth saving. And so the philosophy, at least at trial, was to say that he was stable for a while. And if you give him the death penalty, he's got two things that caused him to commit this murder. One, access to drugs, access to weapons. If he gets life in prison, he's not going to have any drugs, not going to have any weapons. What harm would it do? And that's the tactic that they pursued, because they didn't have the good stuff on him, because everything, even at school, attacking the principal, using drugs at a young age, t- taking the drugs away from him. So really what they were saying, not that he's a great guy or anything, but the mitigation was he's not going to be a future danger in essence, because the two worked hand, well, they counterbalance each other. If he's in jail, in prison for the rest of his life, well, if he gets a life sentence, then he's not going to have access to drugs and he's not going to have access to weapons. So, there is no need to execute him. That was their position.
Okay, Larry, you've tried capital cases.
I have not.
You have not.
I have not.
You're stand ready, willing, and able to try capital
cases. Absolutely not.
You don't want to.
No.
You don't want
to
get into that business
no,
at all.
No.
Jack, you tried capital.
They live with you forever, Ray. A capital case lives with you for the rest of your life, even after you're dead. I don't know Joe Cannon.
Yeah.
But I know a lot about him.
Yeah, but Joe is, I used to, step over him on the sidewalk.
He used to buy, he's the only guy I've known who buys wigs at garage sales. I've never seen, they look like a bird nest he put on top of his head. It was the damnedest thing I've ever seen.
But you
both tried as a defense lawyer and prosecuted capital cases.
Absolutely, yeah, I have.
Do we have a culture? If you get a capital case, if something comes over your transom and it's a capital case, can you pick up the phone and call them in and say they're going to kill this one and they're not going to kill this one?
Well, most of the lawyers now won't even take them.
I know, but do we have a culture, a professional culture, where you can read the tea leaves on initial interview with a client?
I think it's more of a procedural thing, because I've always said the way our death penalty statute is written in Texas, like I wanted to get into this with that professor from California some years ago, because it's almost an automatic. As soon as they file it, it's almost automatic, and here's why. They only try death penalty cases in real heinous crimes. And if you're found guilty of a heinous crime, that per se is going to be future dangerousness, because you committed that heinous crime. They postulate that you're going to do it in the future. So as soon as they find you guilty, it's almost automatic death, it seems to me. And the procedure is what I think more than anything creates a likelihood of death penalty cases and the people getting death penalties in Texas.
Well, do you get what I'm trying to get at? What is going on in the culture of the professionals in the field, the prosecutors and the defense lawyers? That would constitute a culture. I mean, if you go to
I think Jim's argument here is that whether you have the culture or not is irrelevant. What you have is a structure which, once it's filed, it's very likely that if they're found guilty, you're gonna get the death penalty.
And what that does, that creates a feeling among lawyers that here's what happens. I've been involved, like I say, on both sides of the road in this. And what you do, you have several enemies when you're a defense lawyer and you're in a death penalty case. Number one, you've got to look out for the state. That's your enemy number one. They're trying to kill your client. But you also got to keep your eyes peeled for writ lawyers who will literally accuse you of anything. You would be, I don't know if you'd be shocked or not, but on some death penalty cases I've been involved in, you'd be surprised what I've been accused of doing. I was accused once of even talking to the jury during the trial itself. And, somehow on the other side of the fence, Ray, those who are against the death penalty because they feel it's a worthy cause don't have much scruples in what they would do to accuse you to get, because they think the end justifies the means. And it's almost as bad as the people for death penalty advocates being bloodthirsty. Those on the other side will literally lie about you, literally make up stories about you, and literally make up evidence about you just to get a stay of execution or just to get a case set aside because they feel like it's justified, because they are a disciple fighting for what they consider to be a good cause, and they don't have many scruples in doing that. And I've seen
that
happen.
Well, is the difference between capital cases and other cases the emotion of the end result?
Well, absolutely. You're playing extremely big stakes.
In terms of the cultural atmosphere that you're raising, Ray, one thing that I've heard recently that I've talking to a few lawyers do capital cases. And the state can ordinarily, because the facts are so heinous, can ordinarily get death so long as they can have a clean trial. So that's what they're looking for, is a clean trial, a trial without reversible error. And one lawyer that I talked to who had handled capital cases in the
past. So these cases, for the most part, are won or lost on the appellate process.
If there is reversible error, then the case just comes back. So the situation I'm talking about is that there was one lawyer I talked to who has handled capital cases and done a good job in it, keeping death off of his client. He picked up a capital case once, and he was trying to figure out, how do I keep this man from dying? In the middle of the case, he was appointed to it. The family got together, and his only thing was, it'll be a win for me if I can keep my client from being killed. While he was handling the case, the family got together some money and went out and hired a lawyer who probably could not handle a death penalty case without committing reversible error. Once that lawyer was hired, the state took the death penalty off the table.
Right.
And this lawyer
said,
he says he went to the state and said, what is it with me? That's all I wanted you to do. And the DA thought, the prosecutor thought he was complimenting him and says, with you, we would have tried a clean case and we would have gotten a clean kill. With this guy, there'd be so much error that it might come back again and again, a Penry kind of situation.
Yeah, well, I got hired to go testify in a homicide case in Fort Worth, and it was a capital case. And so there was money for expert witnesses and all that. And so I went up there not to testify for or against anything, but to testify as to what I knew about the dynamic of killing a gay person. And what I'd experienced in investigating homicide. The minute I walked in the courtroom and sat down with the prosecutor who wanted to know who I was and where the hell I'd come from, did my credentials, they took capital off the table. And all I did was show I never testified.
The prosecutors have so much discretion in every criminal case. But the capital murder cases where death is an option, it just amazes me how much discretion they have. But they can decide pretty much who lives or dies based on one set of facts, heinous evidence. If they decide not to pursue the death penalty, it's off the table. And if they decide to pursue the death penalty, oftentimes in a heinous case, which is all of them, almost all of them are, the lawyer considers, the defense lawyer considers keeping the person alive as being a win.
A win. Well, the guy actually pled out for a number of years that he would have survived defending that case. But just showing up and showing him a resume was enough to change.
And when the DA looked at all that and decided, do I really want to go through all of this?
Mm-hmm.
Or can I get something?
Make a deal.
Yeah.
There's another case. We've got a documentary floating right now. If we had had a trial, and this is where Mike Anderson, former district attorney and prosecutor in this case, and I are in total agreement. If we had had one trial out of 10 possible trials in the homicide of Paul Broussard, if we'd had one trial, the state would have been unable to prove the basic premise of hate crime. Now, none of these cases were capital cases.
Mm-hmm.
But
remember, we talked about that.
If we had one trial, because the function of a trial is to what? Find the truth? In an adversarial environment? Is that what that is about?
Supposedly.
How does that work, Jim?
How does what work? I mean, how does it work to finding the truth? Theoretically, the way it's supposed to work.
Theoretically,
you have
communism is supposed to work.
Competent lawyers on both sides advocating different positions, and by advocating different positions, it come out with justice in the end, but it doesn't work out that way. That's how it's supposed to work, but it does.
Does it not work out that way often,
no.
Or does it not work out
The reason
out
it
that
doesn't,
way?
Because it's a stacked deck. When you go to trial, the judge is on the DA side, the police, the public are on the DA side. You're like a bastard child at a family reunion. You're the only one left out there. And
with
it's a
no
stacked
money.
Deck. And you haven't got the money, and you can't get the money to fight the resources of the state got. It's kind of like
the state is effectively, has
effectively
unlimited resources.
Well, not only that, they've also got generally the sympathy of the jury to begin with, because you don't hear people running around talking about we need to have less law and order, because I believe the DAs are wonderful, the police are wonderful, and you come in with your scurly clients, how they look at it, and they figure that a defense lawyers, and they have that attitude that we approve of people's conduct because we defend their lives. It's not that we approve of their conduct at all, but yet we have that perception, and it's a stacked deck going in, because really the truth of the matter is it's not having the state having to prove it. It's us having to get the state, catch the state doing something wrong to prove they're bad. We don't win cases, the state loses them.
Well, I remember this quote that's attributable to Sir Thomas More, who was the attorney for Henry VIII. I would give the devil the benefit of the law for my own sake.
Somehow that didn't show up in my studies of more, but I'll hunt it down. Is there an example of another culture that you can think of that this original objective pursuit of the truth? I mean, you were to convention of preachers?
Well, here's what I think the problem is, Ray. It's like, for example, I had a friend years ago who said that Christianity went astray when they made preachers a profession. Because at that point, the preachers had to depend upon the goodwill of the people to get a job and make money, and therefore they couldn't take the right stand. When you have people who are politicians, and let's go back, the laws on death penalty are passed by politicians. Mm-hmm. They want to get elected. It's mm-hmm. politicized. Mm-hmm. And nobody gets elected, at least recently. Everybody gets elected on law and order platforms.
There's some change in that.
It's changing slowly, but that change. And then you have those legislators passing that legislation. Then you have DAs that come in who don't want to keep their job. And what they're going to do is go at the whim of the public, especially in cop killings. You will notice every time a cop is killed, Devin Anderson squeals like a goat in heat and says, mm-hmm. I'm going to try the case.
Oh, yes.
And so you know why? Because it's a voting block. That's exactly why. Plus they park their cars and kiss their rear ends. And, so it's politicized. And the only way you're going to eliminate that is knock the politics out of it. And there's a...
And that's not possible.
Well, that's a way to do that.
Okay, Larry wants a piece of this.
No, I just want to make sure we're okay.
Yeah,
time.
Yeah, I'm watching time here, and if I get off score, he'll scream at me. Jack?
There's, piggybacking on what Jim said, I don't think you'll never get the politics out of it.
I think there's a way to do it, Jack. Here's what I think we should do. I think we should have, hired lawyers. And on some cases, you're a prosecutor, and on some cases,
Isn't
you're
that
a defense
the way they do
lawyer,
it,
and some cases, you're a judge, and you're not elected to any of it. You're a part of the bar. As a part of the bar, you've got to do death penalty cases. In some instances, you're going to be a judge on the case, some a defense lawyer, and some a prosecutor. And when you have professional judges and professional prosecutors, this is where you get the politics involved in. You can do that. You can cure that problem.
What percentage of practicing lawyers are qualified to change roles like that?
It's not the truth, man. See, I've done both. It's
yeah,
not
I know
that
you've
difficult.
Done that.
I told Judge Love years ago. I said it's really simple. Being a prosecutor is real simple. You got to learn two questions: what's your name and what happened next. If you can put those two sentences together, you can try any case on the planet. Then, if you're real retarded, you can become a judge. All you have to remember then are three phrases: sustained, overruled, and move along. You say sustained if both of them frown, then say overruled if both of them frown, then say move along. You can say those three phrases, you can be a judge anywhere on the planet. And it's not that difficult. If you're a competent lawyer, you can prosecute a case, you can judge a case, and you can defend a case as easily as doing either one of the three.
Well, I'm going to take over because time to move KPFT into the next program. Execution Watch is a live news program that broadcast only during Texas execution. More information, including videos and podcasts and previous shows, as well as the dates of upcoming shows, can be found at our website, http://executionwatch.org. or just put Execution Watch in your search engine, we'll find it. My name is Ray Hill. I'm the host of the program. The real work of the program is done by the producer of the program, who is Elizabeth Stein, and you can find her on Gmail, elizatex.usa on Gmail. We were engineered tonight by Robert Gardner. Our technical director, and the reason you're able to hear this on the Internet globally, is Otis McClay. Our legal staff is, of course, Jim Skelton, who is an educator and a retired attorney, native Texan, who understands this well. He has tried cases as a defense attorney and as a prosecutor. Their staff in that section includes Susan Ashley, who's got waivers tonight, Larry Douglas, who has the voice of God, Michael Gillespie, who has left a little bit early tonight, and, of course, Jack Lee, who arrived a little bit late. From our Huntsville office, we get a report for Pat Hartwell, and Dave Atwood was reporting from the vigil here in Houston. If you're interested in death penalty issues, they're having luncheon over at the Dominican Sisters Convent at the corner of Alameda and Holcomb, Mayor Holcomb's Street. They killed Licho Escamilla tonight. And he may have done some things that made that easier for them to do than not. The next scheduled execution is Rafael Holiday. And that is scheduled for November the 18th. And then we'll stop killing people through the Christmas holidays because there's another execution that they talk about a lot during that time of the year. My name is Ray Hill. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to encourage you to tell your friends, as Victoria Panetti is telling them now, in Texas they're killing people. And you can find out about her at She Monster International. Thank you for listening.
People of Texas, children of God. It's insane in Jesus' name. You know.